satellite of my K1MJM, and you will see in there a picture that you can expand if you want to, of 16 Yagis, with a guy standing in the middle of it, four wide, four high. That's an antenna with roughly 29 decibels of gain on 432. That antenna, on top of 100 feet of tower, in my backyard, where my radio horizon out there is 40 miles, allowed me to summer, winter, spring, and fall talk on single sideband 432 for 180 miles for 4.5 solid years. I just couldn't believe it. 29 dB of gain, 432, all of those QSOs, all of those years, sideband. You put up enough effective area, enough antenna gain, and there is probably no limit. And I eventually found out, I eventually found out that those foam-filled FM8 cables that were the phasing harness were slowly sucking up water into the foam through the polyethylene, the foam, the water vapor was getting in there, and each of those phasing harnesses had a significant number of decibels of extra loss. Had I not known that, had I found that out and replaced them, that antenna, instead of talking 480 miles down to Greensboro, North Carolina, would have periodically talk to Florida on 432 sideband, is my belief. It probably gives you some ideas, Gabe. Think big, and you've got the resources, you can do it. KB2MAR, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Now, each individual vertically polarized beam, how many elements, let's say I want to have two 10-foot, one above the other. I know that the farther you space each individual element, you're going to get more gain per beam. In other words, could I shorten the amount of, use less amount, less elements per beam, let's say like six elements instead of 10 elements, and make the six elements more widely spaced apart amongst elements? Or should I use a 10 element and make them closer together? Back to you.
You got to be careful here now, Gabe. There's a whole lot of old wives' tales when it comes to optimizing the gain of a Yagi. You'll find guys, for instance, I can't think of the name of the company in 1956, very famous company in New Jersey, that was building so-called wide-spaced Yagis. They were trying to convince everybody that if you increase the spacing between the elements, the directors, the parasitic elements of the Yagi, you picked up extra gain. Good sounding theory, not necessarily true. You'll find somebody else who stacks them real narrow, real close, and he thinks he's getting extra gain. If you really want the maximum gain for a particular boom length, there is an ideal number of elements with an ideal length of each individual element. The guy who is probably the world's best expert on this one is Dr. Gunter Hock, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. Dr. Gunter Hock, who has been taking all the world's best Yagi designs, DC to light, any frequency where anyone has ever built a Yagi, with rare exception, he scales that Yagi to 432, mounts it in the anechoic chamber that he had access to at the downstate, at the the Research Institute of the Federal Post Office of Germany, in Darmstadt, Germany, where he lived. He had access to that anechoic chamber. He built a scale model of every one of those antennas and tested them. So he has published a whole bunch of curves and articles and whatever as to what's the maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi if you do a good job of tuning the directors for the right length and the right position of each one. Let me drop. So if you simply Google the word DL6WU, you'll eventually find Gunter Hock's various articles and various curves. And the bottom line of all that is that if you're doing the job of making the directors the right length, the right number of them in the right positions, then there is a given gain per foot of boom that you can get out of a Yagi. As such, he has a very well-published formula. You tell him the number of wavelengths of length of the boom of the Yagi, he can tell you within a small fraction of a dB exactly what gain it is capable of giving you if you do the director tuning job correctly. So length of boom is really the limiting factor. That all those directors out in front, even though your eye doesn't see it, it really is a magnifying glass. It's taking energy from a large diameter of space, much bigger than the Yagi itself. They're taking this big round chunk of energy coming in from space, and by way of magnifying glass-like phenomena, it is focusing all that energy down to the driven element. What are you saying, Eric?
Yeah, I just wanted to say for years I've used this calculator. If you go to the web, and actually there's a download site called Soft Media, but just use it in Google, put in GL60W, and download the Yagi calculator. It's up to version 0.6, I think now, which is I've used it over the years for making different Yagis and different images. It's absolutely wonderful.
Okay, your audio is a healthy 10 dB lower than it should be. Why don't you repeat the essence of that, Eric?
Okay, it's me. I'm sorry. Is this better?
Fantastically. I can hear you now.
All right, what I said was, if you do a Google search for DL6WU and download his Yagi calculator, I've used it for many years, and it covers, the way it's set up, pretty much covers from low VHF up to like 18 gigs, something like that. It's absolutely great. I've made a lot of stuff with it, and, it's improved over the years. It's up to the last version I think I downloaded was 2.6. I'm sure it's even refined it even more. But that's like really one of the best tools you're going to find. K2RWK3J.
So as you can tell, Gabe, there are lots and lots of Yagi designs. Some of them mediocre, some of them pretty good. But the expert on planet Earth from all Eric and I can tell is this guy, Gunter Hawk, DL6WU. He has spent his lifetime studying Yagi antennas, and I mean studying, taking them apart, really figuring out what's going on and what's the maximum performance you can get out of any one of them. You choose any one of his designs. He's got short ones, medium ones, long ones, super long ones, whatever. You choose any one of his designs and design principles. That's going to give you the biggest bang for the dollar in the Yagi-like phenomena. And when it comes to high-gain antennas, it is my belief that in the VHF, UHF frequencies, you can't get more gain per dollar, gain per pound of aluminum, or gain per square foot of wind load than by using well-tuned Yagis. You select whatever boom length you're willing to build. Maybe you're not willing to go above 10 foot of boom length. Maybe you're not willing to go above 25 foot of boom length. Whatever boom length you think you can handle. And then you build it correctly. That's the maximum gain you're going to get on that boom. And if you need more gain than that, you start stacking those. And what's the right stacking distance? We've already given you some information on that, Gabe. And by the time you put this all together, you can build a rock crusher of an antenna if you want to. You have the resources. And it's not rocket science, because some of the hard details have already been ironed out, as you can tell, Gabe. KB2MAR, the guy that's going to blast a hole in the atmosphere with his antenna, K2LIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Gabe.
And 3E06 with a couple of comments from the net. And 3E06.
Gabe first. Go ahead, Gabe.
Definitely going to have to go the Yagi route, because the other way, it's going to be too difficult. Even though I have to use a rotator, but, obviously you're going to get a lot of more gain concentrated in all different directions, which is very desirable. And also the stacking might be a little bit of a challenge because there's more wind loading. That's the thing. Wind loading is the problem. So, and if I'm going to put this, if it's possible to put up on a sniped brick chimney, I have to use angle iron to reinforce the chimney. If I can't go that route, maybe I can get a nice long telescopic mast. I can look into that. N2EL, go right ahead.
Comes to vertical stacking. If you you really want to go hog wild with that one, Gabe, and you're worried about the mast not being strong enough, using tower sections is one way to go. K2CBA, among many other guys, have had as much as 160 feet of tower. And he used Rhone 45, I think he should have used Rhone 55, minor detail. But by putting rotating rings for the guy wires on the tower, you can rotate the whole Don tower with a prop pitch motor at the bottom. He has done that very successfully. And the huge advantage of rotating the tower is now, anytime you want to, you stack any engine. You stack any antenna you want to along the tower, and they all get rotated simultaneously. Aim some of them to the north, some of them to the south, different bands and whatever. As you stack antennas on this rotatable tower, and you rotate that prop pitch motor at the bottom, they all move simultaneously. So you have the resources to make a vertical stack 160 or 200 feet high if you want to, as long as you've got enough property for the guy wires, for the rotating guy rings on the tower. That's the guys who really get serious are doing it that way. The only reason why Dave, K1WHS, isn't rotating the tower is that on the VHF contest, 90-some-odd percent of all of the high activity he's looking for to run up a good score is all along the east coast of the United States, within a couple of hundred miles of the water of the east coast. So by him having a broad enough horizontal beamwidth of the individual Yagis that covers that chunk of real estate, then he can pick up more and more gain without having to worry about rotating them by vertically stacking them as high as his tower will go. And now he's creating this very high gain, what I call beaver tail pattern, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2LIW.
KB2MMY, ready.
MMY, you're on the list, but MAR first. Go ahead, Gabe.
Yeah, the thing is, though, I don't intend to use a tower, though. What I have here is a three-story house here with a nice strong chimney. I want to try to have the chimney reinforced with angle iron first before I could put a nice mast with two Yagis stacked, one above the other, maybe two 10-element Yagis. I might go that route. And, of course, a rotator, too. And I have to look into the wind loading and if the chimney can handle all that. So that's my next project. Let's think MMY. Go right ahead. Go ahead, Ray. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, thanks, Jim, the tech man. I was wondering if I can have a question since the other guy dropped out. If not, it's fine.
You've got it. Fire away with your question, Ray. We've gone down the list of people who signed in.
One final comment, Dave.
And a comment to the net.
Oh, was it Eric that wants to make a comment? Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the one thing that I did want to say is that, you know, it's great to have, like, all the games, but one single 11-element, or even if you're into a big antenna, like a 22-element long gun or two movies, is amazing. And it's like, you really don't need more than that, you know. I don't know if he lives in the city or near the city. I used to live in Astoria, and, you know, I had my satellite. I had my 22-element long gun. But the coverage that you get out of it, it's fabulous. I mean, why do you need more gain in that? That's all. There's, you know, there's a limit to how much you can go. K2IWK2.
What you said is a very popular opinion, Eric, but I've got the hard evidence for something else. When you once again, when you go to LimarTechNet.com and you look at the picture of that 16 Yagi array on 432. It was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep, 3,500 cubic feet of antenna. And I'm standing in the middle of it for size comparison. 304 elements, 29 dB of gain.
You live on how many acres?
I live on 1 acre of property, and I could have built that antenna on a quarter acre of property, if you know what I mean. The main thing I'm trying to tell you, though, is that I had switching relays in the middle of that phasing harness, so I could feed all 16 Yagis at once, or one vertical string of 4 Yagis, or one single Yagi on top. Each individual Yagi, 19 elements. 16 of them, 304 elements total. As I flip the relays and go to more and more Yagis, the signal always got stronger by exactly the right number of dB, and the distance increased. So if you say that beyond some number of dB of gain, you're not gaining anything, that's not what I saw. I always used the...
I think you're missing my point.
You're making the point that one single Yagi is good enough.
Well, it depends on where your threshold...
Yeah, but I mean, if you're looking to do like hundreds of miles of CX, there's no limit. But if you're just wanting to talk to people and have, you know, really good communications with them, and you know, maybe do a little bit of short CX, it's, you know, one heck of a lot better than having a quarter wave ground plane on your roof.
Well, let's find out what Gabe's real intention is. Gabe, do you like DX? Do you like to be strong to the local repeaters? Why did you choose only vertical polarization? Sideband will quadruple your range if you're willing to use horizontal polarization and sideband. So what is your real motivation here, Gabe? Other than a lot of gain, how far do you want to talk? What do you want to do with it? KB2MAR, K2LIW in the tech net.
Don't be like Dick. I think it's a replacement for a power level.
I know you're making a comment, Eric, but you dropped back to low audio and we're missing it.
I'm being a wise guy. I'm saying, you know, the bigger your thing is, a male is a big thing.
That wasn't my motive. I wanted to find out. I had the resources of building that antenna. I said, what the heck? And once I started using it, I said, why in the world didn't I do this earlier? KB2MAR, Gabe, you're about to tell us what is your real motivation, and maybe your answer is right now you don't know. But just like anything else in the world of pure research, you build a big enough antenna, a high enough power transmitter, a sensitive enough receiver, you're going to hear things at a greater distance, you're going to be talking to more people, you're going to be picking more brains, you're going to be having more fun. That's an opinion. So what is your real motivation here, Gabe, if you happen to know? KB2MAR, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Because of the chimney mount, that's sort of like clued us in as to what he can do.
He's capable of bracing the living daylights out of his chimney all the way down to the foundation of the house. He has the resources to do that, or to put up a tower alongside of the house. Those are details. What's your real motivation here, Gabe? Go ahead, Gabe.
Two six, November 2, Echo Oscar with a comment from the net.
Gabe, go ahead and make your comment, Gabe.
Well, I intend to do as far as possible communication, DX. I also forgot to mention, I also would want to use circular polarization for if I want to do satellite communications. I have a TS-2000 Kenwood transceiver. I want to go on sideband 2, of course, 144.2. And I would probably want to get circularly polarized in case I want to do the satellite stuff too. So that's another thing to consider, because once the antenna's up there, in the future, to take it down and go up again, I would want to have something circularly polarized to be better equipped for the future. But right now, I want to just go on sideband and talk as far as I can. Give me to me up back to that.
Okay, without a doubt, sideband is going to give you a hell of a lot more range than FM can ever give you. On top of that, good low noise figure on sideband on 2 meters with horizontal polarization. Almost all the guys on sideband on 2 meters are using horizontal Gabe. And as such, where you talked about vertical before, I'm not so sure if that's quite the way you want to go. Circular polarization, except for satellite work, is not worth the effort, in my opinion, when it comes to terrestrial communication. For instance, the broadcast people, every decade or so, we go through another series where somebody thinks there's going to be magic of circular polarization, and they go down that particular road. When it comes to terrestrial communication, where you're always living with ground reflection, the clockwise signal that you launch from the antenna after reflecting off the ground becomes counterclockwise. You then got a direct wave signal that's clockwise, an indirect wave that's counterclockwise, and the two are competing with each other, and you end up with some pretty strange polarizations at the receiving site. So circular polarization for terrestrial communication, I'm not convinced it's worth all the extra effort. For satellite work, without a doubt. But now when it comes to creating a whole lot of, let me drop.
Detect, you know, I used to use my circular polarizer as a separate horizontal, simple vertical. It worked out very well.
Yeah, I barely heard what you said. You're back to low audio again, Eric. And yes, one of the best ways of making circular polarization is literally make a single boom per Yagi where it has horizontal element and vertical element on the same boom with a horizontal driven element and a vertical driven element. And now you can have all polarization diversity you like. Feed the horizontal, your horizontal. Feed the vertical, your vertical. Feed them both simultaneously in phase, and then your slant 45 degree linear polarization. Feed them out of phase, your slant 45 degrees to the left with linear polarization. Feed them equal power 90 degrees out of phase, with one delay you're clockwise, with the other delay you're counterclockwise. So with two separate feed lines, with cross-polarized Yagi elements on the same boom, you've now got complete polarization diversity. By flipping a switch in the shack, so to speak, you can choose whatever polarization you like. And depending on what you're doing in that particular part of day, one polarization could very well do a lot better than another. And you've heard about that experiment I did where the guy in southern New Jersey, I keep forgetting his call letters, he was running four Yagi, 2 meters, on top of 100 feet of tower in southern New Jersey, 200 miles away. I'm talking to him from my mobile, and I was flipping back and forth between a horizontal square loop antenna on the mobile and a vertical 5/8 wave whip. And as I'm going up the New York State Thruway and then over to Route 90 and all the way over to Utica, and I'm 200 miles from him, talking to him on 2 meter sideband, whether I use horizontal or vertical to receive him didn't make any difference. When the signal is sifting through all of those trees, through all of that houses and water towers and everything else, by the time it got to me, there was no significant polarization left, if you know what I mean. It had all possible polarizations. At
repeater, timeout.
It had all possible polarizations unless I went to a scenic overlook, and then the co-pole was the stronger signal. So you can play with polarization, you can play with high gain, you can play with aiming, and should you be beefing up your chimney as opposed to putting a tower alongside of the house? These are some of the decisions you've got to make, Gabe. But if you really want longest possible range, and that's a lot of fun all by itself, studying long-range propagation. And one of the crazy things we discovered, for instance, over the 480 mile between me and Greensboro, twice during each half-hour QSO, the signal would slowly peak up to 30 dB above the noise. And we finally found out we were reflecting our 432 sideband signals off of the aircraft that flew between New York City and Florida. They flew over the midpoint, Washington, D.C. They were at 35,000 feet, and the signal we got reflecting off those aircraft made a 30 decibel increase in signal strength. Real fun to watch that operation. And there's a lot more to that story. So long-range propagation, you're going to get a lot of fun out of it there, Gabe. Good luck with that project. Ray, KC2, MMY, what would you like to ask us about? We're discussing anything except antennas tonight, Ray. I'm having some fun with you. You got it, Ray. K2LIW.
2EO, Dick, with a comment. And 2ECHO Oscar.
Oh. Okay, Dick. But I wanted to ask, why does light that you can see, visible light, go through things like glass? Why does it go through certain objects and not through other so-called opaque objects? What's the secret there? Maybe tell what's going on. Thanks, KC2MMY.
I don't think I've got a good answer for that one, Ray. Why is light going through glass transparent for certain wavelengths? By the way, the light of infrared doesn't go through the glass. So certain waves, you go to a lower frequency, which is far infrared, and it doesn't go through the glass. And the signals that do go through the glass, the funny glass that works at infrared, is black to your eye. So each substance has certain frequency regions where it will transmit the signal and other frequency regions where it will not. And what's the explanation for that? Somebody's got to help me here. How, who's got an explanation for that one? Give us your call letters right now.
Fast chemistry, Dave.
Okay, yep. To call it chemistry is nice, but what is happening at the molecular level? Why can the light at optical frequencies go through glass and at infrared frequencies it doesn't? How does chemistry explain that one, Eric? KE2EJ, give us some audio. K2LAW in the tech man.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, there's different formulations of different kinds of glass that some will allow different spectra of light to pass through it. If you go to the photo store, you'll find that you can actually get glass, what we would call gels and filters, and they are, in essence, tuned circuits. The tuned circuits we're talking about is really at the molecular level. So, as you know, every atom has a spectra associated with it when it's excited. And those spectra work in two ways. They absorb light at different wavelengths, or they absorb energy at different wavelengths. Right. And they pass light, or they pass energy at other wavelengths. So you can look at it from either way. And when you put different combinations, let me know that. When you put different combinations of chemistry and actually get into a glass blower, we go up to Corning every now and then. Make our own glass, make our own art. Depending upon what you other atoms you put in with the cylinder, with the sand that you're fusing, you're making a laser that is, in essence, you can think of it like a spectrograph, where this is doing its thing on the light that's passed through it. You know that you can make glass that attenuates light but doesn't stop it. You can make glass that stops light. You can make glass that passes red and stops every other color. You can make glass that will pass cyan, which is red and green, and it will stop blue from going through it, etc. K2IW, K2IW.
Good information, Eric, and I'm going to add something to it. Glass usually is made out of something that is what we call solid, and most things that are solid are really, it's a matrix. In other words, it's a bunch of molecules that you think are locked in place. Well, they're really locked in place with a bunch of springs. What you and I call temperature is where the mechanical motion of those objects held together with springs are moving more violently, mechanically, and we call that a higher temperature. Those individual molecules, my atoms of the material, of the glass, have certain frequencies at which they will vibrate back and forth and transmit the signal through the glass, transfer it from one molecule to the next. The springs that are connecting between one molecule and the next molecule allows them to transmit energy at certain frequencies. That's my guess as to what's going on. Put it all together, I think you can see how these are bandpass filters, so to speak, Ray. KC2MMY. I know you haven't got the whole answer, but maybe we've started giving you the beginning of an answer. You got it, Ray. K2RIW.
Tuio, Greg, I got a few comments, then. Tuio, when you get a chance.
Okay, Jack, yeah, that's a good start, and now you gave me a challenge, so now I'm going to have to Google it and see what else I can find, but since I didn't get a complete answer this time. But, okay, thanks for the info, and Eric also. So back to that, KC2MM1.
To Echo Oscar, Dick.
And as you find more and more about this, Ray, because I guarantee there's a lot more to it, this is another one of those situations where if you think the problem is simple, you don't understand the problem. You dig deep enough, none of these problems are simple, but they all are understandable to some degree. As you find out more about it, please come back and tell us what you find. I think it's time we go over to the mailbag, John. I know you've got quite a few of those that we should be going through. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
N2EO, Dick, I think I'm being selectively ignored. I thought you were... Dick, K2R...
KC2WGB. Beanie, Dick, everyone on the net. Okay, I had a question that came in from Sal. Let me make sure I'm getting through with this.
Can I make a comment? To we you.
Nick, as you're aware, I forwarded an email to you from Sal, W2RMS, had a question about a construct which I sent you a picture of. Did you get a chance to look at that, and do you have any comments that you'd like to bring forward? KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I sure did get the picture, John, and I sure did review it. And what a person comes up with a seemingly radical new antenna. My way of looking at it first is, does it pass the smell test? In this case, the answer is yes, it does pass the smell test. When it comes to an antenna, you've heard me say it so often, resonate first, then you can radiate. So the first question is, can that antenna resonate at the frequencies that are desired? This antenna has got a large flat plate on the bottom, connected by a vertical rod, and the top of that rod goes to a fairly large metallic cage of screening or chicken wire or whatever material. So can you make resonance between that upper cage, the rod, and the lower plane of material? Absolutely. Once it resonates, will it radiate? Absolutely. As long as you've made it lossless. Is that a good antenna? Absolutely. Is it a broadband antenna? There, you get a little bit more of a problem. Do you have to retune it when you go to different frequencies? But can that be a good antenna? Can you put it in the attic of your house? And will it do a pretty good job at the frequencies where it's designed? I think the answer is yes. I know you got the more you want to ask or comment about this one, John. KC2WGB, K2IIW. And by the way, you first ought to start off with, because I'm short memory here, start off with the model number and the name of the antenna so that people can look it up and they can get on the same page with us, if you know what I mean. You got it, John.
Don't ignore me, Dick. And N2EO,
you're not being ignored. Every time you come on, they dump on you. You cannot be heard. There's no purpose in turning it over to you. I don't have the model number, Dick. All I have is Sal and his call sign. I didn't write the model number down, although I do have that in my email. And by the way, what I looked at on the narrative on the antenna, there were some comments about how much you would have to sacrifice to be able to achieve transmission, and it was much less than 100%. I believe they were saying something in the 70% area. But if properly tuned, shouldn't that work perfectly?
Okay, I don't remember reading the word sacrifice. Maybe they're talking about sacrificing length or sacrificing bandwidth. When an antenna is built out of the right kind of materials, and you've got the right kind of impedance match to it, in theory, you can run near 100% efficiency. And you can always prove that by putting 100 watts into it or 10 watts into it, run a key down for 10 minutes, turn off the RF power, go over there and touch everything. If everything is ice cold, then it the law of conservation of energy says that if I'm sending 100 watts of energy down the transmission line and I've got a very low standing wave ratio, which means none of it's coming back to me, so all going in one direction, and if all goes into an object that I call antenna, give it any other name you like, and after 10 minutes of putting 100 watts into it, it runs ice cold, there's no other thing you can be doing except radiating that signal into space. You may not like the exact antenna pattern you're going to get. You may not like the bandwidth you're going to get, but it's going to be radiating that signal. And so when he's talking about 70% performance, is he talking about energy input versus energy radiated? Is he talking about bandwidth? Is he talking about gain by comparison to something else? What parameter is he using when he talks about 70% performance? Over to you, John, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. He was talking about efficiency, that you're not going to get that, 96 or 97% that you claim can be done if it's properly tuned, which I look at it, okay, it's not attractive. It's kind of boxy looking, but it looks like it could be effective. By the way, it's called the GAP Super C, Charlie. And it has a number, let's see, it has a patent number, 579-6369. That's 579-6369.
I wonder what he used as a comparison when he said 70%. Maybe he was comparing it to a full-size vertical ground plane, and he's looking at gain of a reception. If it had 70% efficiency, and I put 100 watts into it, does that mean 30 watts is going to be turned into heat? My hand, and with rare exception, can easily feel the difference of about 1 or 2 watts of dissipation within an antenna. If that antenna is dissipating 30 watts, that's getting hot. It's all made out of conductive materials and transmission line and impedance matching devices. What's dissipating 30 watts if I put 100 watts into it? However he rated the 70%, I think he's being super conservative. I think it's a lot higher than that. I think it's closer to 98%, because with 100 watts into it, I'm having trouble dissipating that antenna built out of good materials, unless he's put a whole bunch of carbon granule paint on it, or made sure he's got lousy, rusty nail contact somewhere. Other than that, it's got to radiate the signal. I can't see what's going to get 30 watts of heat. What's going to get hot on that antenna? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IOW.
I agree, Dick. I don't see that being a problem. And for those who are listening, this antenna, this C, Super C, covers 20 meters, 17 meters, 20, 15 meters, 12 meters, 10 meters, and let's see, reflection coefficient of 2 to 1 without a tuner. Those are pretty good specs.
What does the word efficient mean? I mean, what's an efficient antenna? An antenna that takes power and puts every little bit of it out, or it hears better than another antenna? What do they mean?
I would start off with efficiency from a transmitter point of view, Eric. If I put 100 watts into the antenna, and if less than 1 or 2 watts is being dissipated, obvious by the fact that it runs ice cold, then by definition, 98% transmitting efficiency is taking place. That makes you almost home free. Because of the law of reciprocity, whatever gain, bandwidth, beam width, front-to-back ratio, 3 dB lobes, side lobes, whatever parameter you measure of an antenna in the transmit mode, unless you've done something very exotic, it's got to have the exact same performance in the receive mode. Now, whether or not your antenna has enough front-to-back ratio so that in the back lobe of your antenna, where you've got an arcing and sparking LIPO transformer that is giving you a whole lot of noise, and that you don't have the right kind of a noise blanker on the receiver, and therefore it doesn't receive well, that's a fairly separate parameter. But when it comes to real antenna measurements of those parameters in the transmit mode, I think you're almost home free if your transmitter mode tells you what you want to see. That's my opinion on that one, Eric. KE2EJ for a rebuttal. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, you're going to get one. K2IW, K2EJ. I mean, here's the point. What is it that, you know, I mean, we're looking at this from a advertising point of view, really. What makes one manufacturer's antenna more efficient than the next manufacturer's antenna? And it's really a very ambiguous term. I mean, in terms of transfer of energy efficiency, that's perfectly understandable. Put 100 watts into the antenna, you expect 100 watts or thereabout, really close to that amount of energy being radiated by the antenna. You put one antenna next to another, from an advertising point of view, and let's say they have the same specification, one manufacturer claims that his antenna is way more efficient. How is that possible? So it is a rather ambiguous term. To those people who are listening out here, be careful about what you read. K2RW, K3J.
I'm going to partially agree with you, Eric, and I'm going to give an example. If I made an ordinary quarter-wave vertical ground plane antenna, the materials I use for the antenna could be beautiful copper and aluminum, good joints, no oxide. And so of the 100 watts I put into that antenna, none of it comes back to me. None of it's turned into heat. However, I mount that antenna right above the lawn in my backyard, and I'm foolish enough to only lay down 3 ground plane radials. And now, because a lot of that RF energy is sneaking in between those radials and hitting the dirt of my backyard, and that dirt of my backyard is a volumetric resistive material. And now, a hell of a lot of that transmit power is heating up that dirt, making the worms warm in the wintertime, keeping them happy, and now a lot of that energy that isn't reflected back to me is giving me low efficiency because of the way I've configured that antenna and where I put it. Take that exact same antenna, mount it on the top of 100 feet of tower so that now the dirt is 100 feet further away from it, and now that low efficiency because of ground absorption will essentially disappear. So I can take an efficient antenna and I can use it in ways that make it inefficient even though I've used good materials. Maybe this is close to what you're referring to here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Can I sell you a can of antenna wax?
Yeah, sometimes as long as it's got the word antenna on it, it's my favorite subject, I'm probably going to buy it, Eric, particularly from you. Go right ahead.
That's just my point. Take two antennas and put them one next to each other, and they won't behave exactly the same either. But, I just think that, you know, when people start boasting that this is, because the way this was described on the radio, this antenna has an efficiency of 70%, 70% of what? I mean, you know, it sounds like a good advertising term to me.
If he had a little bit more understanding of antenna theory, from my point of view, I think he's being super conservative with his 70% number. I think the real number is considerably higher. As long as he hasn't mounted that 3 inches above a salt marsh, where he's got some real, or the dirt in my backyard, where he's got some real resistive volumetric material, which is going to absorb some energy. As long as he's put it in a good spot, and as long as he hasn't done something like putting rusty nails, rusty bolts into the thing when he assembled it, I think that antenna is capable of 90%, 98% efficiency. Too bad you haven't seen the photograph of it. Eric is going, John is capable of mailing you a copy of the thing he mailed me. Once you see this thing, it's got a large screening area, which I seem to remember was something like 10 or 15 feet wide, 10 or 15 foot square, which is the... let's call it the counterpoise of this antenna. It's got a vertical rod going to what you and I would call a tap hat capacitor. But his tap hat capacitor is a large cage of screening material, a five-sided or a six-sided cage. So it has all the raw ingredients, from my point of view, of taking all the RF energy you put into it and radiating it somewhere into space. You may not like the vertical main lobe you're going to get, the vertical beam width you're going to get. You might not like the VisWare bandwidth on some of those bands, but still on the places where you've tuned it correctly, I think that has all the raw ingredients of being a high efficient transmitter. And now, if it can transmit well, what would stop it from receiving well? Give me a couple of words on that, Eric. How could I build an antenna that has, let me pick it the number, 98% transmitting efficiency? Why would it not have 98% efficiency in the receive mode?
Repeater, timeout.
So once again, why would it not have 98% receive efficiency if I'm comparing the exact same antenna pattern, if you know what I mean, and the exact same polarization? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW. Give us enough audio, Eric.
All right, now you want to put me on the spot. K2LIW, K2J. In theory, okay, if you've got an antenna that has a really good terminating impedance, you've got nothing coming back, and you have a piece of equipment that has a good input termination, especially on the receiver side, there's no reason why that antenna shouldn't operate well, except that, using your example of of the radials absorbing, you know, the ground absorbing energy. Those kinds of rules can apply in receiving waves. You can transmit efficiently well and yet still have all this weak energy not make it into your antenna system. K2RIW, KJJ.
We have Vic with a couple of comments.
If I like the pattern that it transmits, if I mounted it into a place where it's not coupling its valuable RF energy into the dirt, I've now mounted the antenna high enough up. And in the photograph of where this guy is using it, he's using it in the attic space of a two-story house, or it's a three-story house. So he's got it above ground, and whether or not the metallic objects in the attic of his house, his household wiring and his air conditioner ducts or whatever, whether or not they're interfering with the pattern could be taking place, but you can't blame the antenna for that. You blame the guy who put the antenna in that location. So if I put it in a reasonable location, on the top of my tower, my 100-foot tower, I put this antenna on the top of my tower, and of all the power I put into it, 99% of it is radiated to space. Assume I know the vertical beam with the horizontal beam with the frequency, and now I'm going to pick a number out of the air. I'm using it on 10 meters. I'm transmitting on 10 meters, and on the horizon, over isotropic, it has 2 dB of gain over isotropic. And I'm listening to a guy from the north. I'm transmitting to a guy from the north. Then I flip over to the receive mode. Why wouldn't I get the exact same performance in that scenario, Eric? Why wouldn't I get 2 dB of over isotropic gain in the receive mode like I got in the transmit mode when I listened to that guy talking to me from the north on 10 meters with the right polarization? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, before we go any further, you're now throwing in variables you didn't mention before. Are we going to include these variables for, like, the ionosphere and the path, the things that have to go through, or is that included in this conversation now?
To a degree it is, but there's a slight complication there. Everything obeys the law of reciprocity with reference to antennas, except the ionosphere. So I may transmit a vertically polarized signal with this particular antenna to my buddy in London, and the signal takes 2 bounces through the ionosphere to get to London on 10 meters, and it arrives in London vertically polarized. And the guy in London sends a vertically polarized signal back to me, and because of the crazy characteristics called Faraday rotation of the ionosphere, which does not obey reciprocity, that signal from London launched vertical may come back to me horizontal. And this antenna is a vertical antenna. It's not going to respond to the horizontal signal. So in that scenario with the ionosphere, I would think I've got an antenna failure. Well, if I got the right kind of a rotator on the antenna where I can rotate it so that it's now a horizontal antenna when I'm receiving, I think I'm back into full operation. So even with the craziness of the ionosphere, I think I can confirm that the antenna has reasonable transmitting efficiency and the exact same receiving efficiency once I've taken out this crazy characteristic of the ionosphere. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, you're K2IW, K2EJ. You know, you just changed the rules of the game here. You started out talking about the antenna being put in an antenna range in a chamber, in a controlled environment. But, you know, all bets are off when we talk about nature, because that's what we're talking about here. So take it any way in which you please. But that was actually, you know, in the VHF world, in the UHF world, that's the nice part of not only having the antenna that was safely polarized, but being able to move a phase between them and actually change polarization to the point where you actually got the best signal, especially with doing satellite stuff. But it's a cool thing. On HF, it's a bit more difficult. You know? It gets to be very big in size. K2IW, K2IW.
Further comment, Dick?
Yeah, before I go over to you, John, let me give one further challenge to Eric here now. Let's assume I'm using this antenna on, let me pick a number, 6 meters. And I've got it mounted on the top of a 100-foot tower. And by various means, I've measured its transmission efficiency, assuming that I'm not running into craziness of polarization. It's a vertically polarized antenna. I'm talking to my 6-meter buddy in New Jersey. is transmitting a 6 meter signal back to me from New Jersey of the same polarization. How in that environment, Eric, what is the mechanism that you can envision by which my transmitting efficiency could be high and my receiving efficiency could be low? Give me some words as to how the antenna could have a different efficiency in reception than in transmission in that scenario that I'm just trying to describe. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Hi, here we go again, not in a controlled environment. K2IW, K2J. Are we talking in metropolitan area, like here? Where I know damn well, but it's definitely the beam when you start pointing and you have these buildings in the way and it starts doing fun things and you move it slightly a half a degree this way and all of a sudden it's like the signals that you didn't know existed show up. Like multipath doing canceling kind of things that don't necessarily happen at the transmission point because of the distances between the reception and transmission point and the reflection point and the difference in timing. Say the body of water and stuff like that. K2IWK, KJ.
Okay, Eric. By the way, for people who are listening to this quasi-argument, discussion, whatever it is, in my theory, in my opinion, this can be educational. I am now going to play in your ballpark. I'm going to mount this antenna, my theoretical antenna. I'm going to put it in the middle of the marble canyons of New York City. And I'm going to be talking to my buddy in New Jersey on 6 meters, for instance. By way of the telephone line between us, I flip the antenna back and forth in azimuth and elevation in the marble canyons of New York City with all the multipath going on, and by way of the telephone feedback, my buddy in New Jersey said, yep, you've now peaked the signal. Hey, Dick, you've aimed the antenna just right. I'm getting a beautiful signal from you as you transmit to me. And he's playing it back to me on the telephone while I'm doing the aiming and sweep, frequency swishing. I'm doing everything to line up the antenna while I'm transmitting through the marble canyons of New York City to my buddy in New Jersey. And I peak the signal in the transmit mode. Then we flip to the receive mode, and I move nothing. And by the law of reciprocity and the bouncing of the buildings in New York City, I believe obeys reciprocity. The antenna obeys reciprocity. On 6 meters, without talking about a sporadic E opening, this is a ground wave propagation between me and my buddy in New Jersey. That environment is going to obey reciprocity. He now transmits to me. Don't I hear the signal with the same quality that I transmitted? Yes, I'll admit that if the guy next door is running his electric lawnmower or whatever and making a whole lot of ignition noise, yes, that can affect me, but you can't blame the antenna for that. But assuming I don't have some other local source of noise, won't I receive his signal with equal quality that I transmitted? Doesn't that crazy environment still obey reciprocity? That's a challenge to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Now, if you want to break nature down into hundreds of millions of little bits and then turn them all into variables, make them all add up, which maybe we could do sometime in the far future. Roll the dice in. That's the aspect of nature. No two people are exactly alike. Even twins have some differences. If you really want to get into this, I've got something that I would like you, maybe now is not the time, but I would like for you to have a conversation about. And that is, really simply, when we talk about your mounting 20 times to resonate before you can radiate, I want to get, short of Maxwell's equation, I'd like to get into a little bit of how the heat field is generated and how it's affecting the. That's not the time. K2IW,
K2EJ. K2EO,
okay, Eric, you've been hinting that in that environment of the multipath of New York City, that the transmit mode and the receive mode might behave differently, is what you're saying. And you may have to go down to the molecular level, is what you just said to indicate that. Please tell me the mechanism, tell me any mechanism by which the transmit mode from downtown New York City into my buddy in New Jersey on 6 meters wouldn't obey reciprocity and reception. Give me a mechanism by which that path going out versus the path coming in wouldn't be equal. Now,
I'll give you a simple example.
I'm going to try to make believe the buildings are not moving in the wind, and the environment is stochastic. The environment is not changing. But how can the transmit mode and the receive mode of that passive environment not obey reciprocity? That's the challenge. Give me a mechanism for non-reciprocity. You got it, Eric.
All right, let's take 3 points. Let's think of a triangle and the angles that are created by it, right? Now we also have the length between each of these points. Okay, let's say the station we're talking to is in New Jersey, and we're on Long Island, and we pretty much have a straight line between us and that station in New Jersey. So that would be, let's call that the hypotenuse of the triangle. Now, incidentally, we happen to have a building that's, say, north and west. Are you following me so far? And that's the other point on the triangle.
I'm going to let you make that the Freedom Tower. You're getting a beautiful specular reflection off the Freedom Tower at the exact same time on the hypotenuse. I've got this direct path to my buddy in New Jersey. And that hypotenuse and that legs of the triangle, they're there in the transmit mode, and they're there in the receive mode. How does that violate reciprocity? You've got it, Eric.
Okay, just for the sake of saying, let's say the guy in New Jersey is 10 miles from the Freedom Tower, and let's say our guy on Long Island is 20 miles, right? So, the reflected signal and the phase of the reflected signal is going to be at the building that stage is going to be a particular angle after traveling the 20 miles, right? Now, that signal is going to get reflected in some direction, and let's assume that it's going to take the angle which leads down to the receive point. At the point where he's receiving our main signal and the reflected signal, they might, in fact, be in phase with each other. Let us just say. But now, if we do the reverse, okay, before it gets reflected, it's got to travel at 10 miles, which will be a certain phase, and then it's got to travel at 20 miles, and it might be 180 degrees out of phase, or something of that nature. How does that grab you? Or maybe it doesn't.
I think we're violating some physics here, Eric. I say the 20-mile path between me and the Freedom Tower and the 10-mile path from the Freedom Tower to my buddy in New Jersey, each of those individual paths, the 20-mile path and the 10-mile path, must obey reciprocity. However phase angle I got on the 20-mile path and whatever phase angle shift and time delay I got in the 10-mile path, when I am transmitting...
Well, how good is the reflector?
Are you telling me that when the signal comes from me to Freedom Tower to New Jersey, that angle of reflection and that reflection coefficient is going to change in angle of reflection and reflection coefficient when we go the other way, 10 mile first, 20 mile second? Are you telling me that the building is going to be selective on whether or not the signal goes from east to west or west to east? Where does the intelligence of the building come from to do that? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Now, let's say the corner of the building is positioned in between the two of us, and one surface is, slightly tilted towards the west, and the other surface is slightly tilted towards the east, whereas at the angles at which the waves hit them, not going to reflect exactly in the same direction on each face, is it? Which might lead to the slight time difference. I mean, think about it. When we first put the World Trade Center up, all the people up north had ridiculous problems trying to see a picture without ghosts, and simply because of the time difference. And depending upon where you were, it was different because the sheath had only been put up so high, it only reflected it in a certain angle, and the higher it went, of course, the worse the problem got, and it also went to the west and went to the east somewhat. And it was all about the surface of the building.
Let's boil this down to the basic, Eric. I've got an ordinary bathroom mirror, the kind that you've got a handle on the bottom of.